This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Author and critic Maureen Corrigan looks at an American masterpiece in her latest book, and she says it was more than just professional interest that drove her. So We Read On is about F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. And it's a book Maureen Corrigan says she's passionate about. In her book, she takes us to her home in Queens, New York, where she first read the book in high school. And she chats with her old English teacher and talks with a group of teenagers as they, too, take part in a rite of passage, the reading of The Great Gatsby. Maureen Corrigan is the book critic for NPR's Fresh Air. She'll be in Asheville tonight to read at Malaprop's Books, and she'll be in Chapel Hill this Friday to read at Flyleaf Books. But first, she is with us. The full title of the book is So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Maureen Corrigan, welcome to The State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Oh, it's good to talk with you, Frank.
Why does it endure? Spoiler alert. This book is a classic. It is considered by many, and I know you, as the great American novel. What do you think makes it so?
Well, I'll quote a wise student I had a few years ago. He came into my office, and he said, "It's the Sistine Chapel of literature in 185 pages." And I said, "Can I quote you?" Because I think he nailed it. It's short. It's intense. Fitzgerald is a poet. He can pack a lot into his sentences. It's funny. It tells the central fable of the American dream, and it also tells us the American dream is a con, yet it does so in language that makes that dream irresistible.
That's right.
So
no, I mean,
there you have it.
That is a beautiful, I think, summary of kind of what it is. Yeah, it's a dream. It's a myth. It's crazy. It'll kill you. and it's irresistible. And you take us back to the moment of creation, right? Or moments of creation. I love this quote you find where Fitzgerald says, "I want to write something new, something extraordinary and beautiful and simple, plus intricately patterned." I mean, he really set out to write The Great Gatsby, didn't he?
He really did. That's a letter that he wrote to his editor, Max Perkins, about 3 years before, you know, Gatsby actually appears. Gatsby is so over-designed. It's one of the ways in which it's one of the weirdest novels that we have in American literature. I mean, every chapter, for instance, is organized around a party until you get that final chapter, which is the failed party, so to speak, of Gatsby's own funeral. There are 450 time words in The Great Gatsby, and yes, somebody sat down and counted them all. This is a novel that's very aware of deadlines, and the ultimate deadline being Gatsby's death, right? It's got the color symbolism. Everybody remembers the green light. It's got the geographical symbolism, East Egg, West Egg, classical allusions. I say it's the dampest great American novel because it's got water imagery on almost every page. And this is a novel that's very concerned about going under in America, about sinking. But as the novelist Jonathan Franzen says, you know, it's so intricately patterned. It tells the central fable of America. But when you're reading it, you feel like you're eating whipped cream. Mm. It goes down that smoothly.
And that's the language, I suppose, that you...
That's the language.
Yeah. And you say, you point out in this book, you say it's one of the weirdest books in a sense, or it's kind of a misfit in so many ways. And you write that Gatsby is neither character-driven nor plot-driven. Instead, mm-hmm. it is the rarest of literary animals, a voice-driven novel. Tell
it
us
is.
More about that.
You know, the novel is narrated by Nick Carraway, who literally has been carried away by his friend Gatsby. When the novel opens on page one, I'm not ruining it for those of your listeners who haven't ever read Gatsby. Gatsby is dead. This is a retrospective novel. Nick is looking back to 2 years earlier, the summer of 1922, to the events that happened during that one summer. And you know from the passion, the intensity, the longing in his voice that he's going to spend the rest of his life talking about his dead friend, Jay Gatsby. It's a weird novel to be our great American novel precisely because it is retrospective. Everything that happens in this novel has already happened. Mm. Nothing can be changed. What kind of great American novel is this that says there's no possibility for change?
It's not, yeah, with all those time references, you would think we'd have the potential, as we expect in the American dream, to improve our futures. But as you say, that's proscribed in this book, off limits.
Yes.
Carraway's voice, Nick's voice, is a voice that is oblique in many ways, muted, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I think about the Edith Wharton critique that you found in a letter to Fitzgerald about the book, what she, as a writer of a generation earlier, found troublesome about the book. Tell us about that.
She did. Well, she actually wanted, said to Fitzgerald after Gatsby was published, she wrote a very nice letter to him. She praised it a lot. She said she couldn't stop thinking about the dog in the novel, which we see for all of like two sentences. There was a dog at that wild party at Myrtle and Tom's love nest, and she kept wondering what happened to the dog. Wharton was a great dog lover. But she also said, I wish you had filled in more of Gatsby's history and more of his personality. And then she goes on to write, But you'll tell me that's the way of an older generation and, you know, you're being modern. You know, I think that was one instance in which Edith Wharton was probably a better novelist than a literary critic. It's precisely because Gatsby is a cipher and people impose all sorts of fantasies on him that the novel has such power. We're never going to really figure out this enigma of Jay Gatsby. Even his father, who shows up late in the novel, doesn't really know who Gatsby is. And Gatsby, he's so self-created. Nick says something about that he was his own platonic conception of himself. He's a guy who's really always ill at ease in his own skin. He's uncomfortable at his own parties. He arrives late. He leaves early. You know, you always get the sense with Gatsby that he's trying too hard. And the old money rich characters sniff that out about him and they reject him.
And yet he's so irresistible. Nick is always projecting himself into that character, hoping, wishing that he was the success that he pretends to be.
Yeah, yeah. Nick admires him because he's pure, which is what the kids at my old high school said about Gatsby. They loved Gatsby because he was pure. He was a dreamer.
Yeah, but pure in what way? I mean, I think that's, again, the genius. Pure. But, I mean, pure, because he's such a vague character, because he's so vaguely drawn in some ways, you know, yeah, pure if that's how you're feeling about him at the moment, right? Or do you think?
I guess I'm with the kids.
You're with the kids on that?
High school. Yeah, I am.
Well, tell us more about that research and what it meant to you to go back to your school, talk to your English teacher and students at the school.
Isn't that amazing? My English teacher, who must have been 12 when I had her, is still at my old high school. She's now the vice principal, and she's one of those amazing teachers who remembers everybody. So I contacted her because I wanted to go back to the place where I read Gatsby for the first time. I've read Gatsby now well over 50 times, but I wanted to go back to my high school, where, by the way, I didn't particularly like Gatsby the first time I read it. I wanted to hear what kids today who are encountering Gatsby for the first time, what they were saying about it. And the bonus is that my old high school is in Astoria, Queens, kind of close to the Valley of Ashes in The Great Gatsby. So it's in the landscape of the novel. When I went back, it was a few months before the Baz Luhrmann film of Gatsby was due to come out, and the kids were very excited about the prospect of Leonardo DiCaprio playing Gatsby. They weren't so hot on Carey Mulligan. They told me they wanted somebody sexier, hotter to play Daisy, and they suggested Jessica Alba, which I said I had a little few problems with. But one of the amazing moments that I witnessed in my old high school was there was a discussion about that scene in the novel where Daisy starts crying when she sees all the beautiful shirts in Gatsby's closet. And one girl in the class I was sitting in on said she thought Daisy cries because she realizes that Gatsby is no longer the poor boy she first fell in love with. That he's more like her husband, Tom Buchanan now, just another rich guy. I had never heard that, you know, interpretation before. The class got very quiet. Everybody was thinking about it. And, you know, there's nothing in the novel to argue against that reading. I just love the fact that, You know, here again is another moment where Gatsby shows me another possibility, where there's yet another interpretation that I haven't thought of, that the novel allows for that. I think that's one of the marks of a great novel. It always shows you something new.
Something new in every generation, that every generation can find meaning within its own context. Did you find students looking back to the context in which it was written, the period in which it's set, the 1920s America, did they care about that?
They did care about that. One of the classes I sat in on had just finished reading Timothy Egan's great book on the Dust Bowl, The Worst Hard Time. So this was a class that was grounding its reading in the historical context. I think they delayed their reading of Gatsby until I could visit, because obviously the Egan book was the 30s, so they went back to the 20s for me. They wanted to talk about the 1920s. They talked a lot about, you know, women and their changing role in the 20s, these flappers who were all of a sudden sexually emancipated and drinking and smoking and dancing and wearing short skirts and voting. But what they also latched onto was the fact that the novel seems to look forward to the end of the great national party of the Roaring Twenties. They talked about the fact that, you know, the lights go out in Gatsby's mansion in the last third of the novel, that things get very dark and somber. And, you know, like a lot of critics, these kids were sort of sensitive to the fact that the novel seems to be looking ahead to a time when things aren't going to be so light and giddy and carefree, and when people are going to have to pay for these good times.
Does that explain why? Because now I think I'd like to talk about the story of the novel itself. Didn't do that well when it came out, and it experienced a revival in the in the World War II period. But tell us about the story of the story.
Yeah, the story of the story is when the novel comes out in 1925. It goes through two printings, totaling about 23,000 copies. Some of that second printing of the novel from 1925 was still moldering away in Scribner's warehouse upon Fitzgerald's death in 1940. He was only 44. He was working in Hollywood as, you know, kind of a patch-up script writer, and he died of probably his third heart attack. So the novel didn't sell. Contemporary newspaper reviewers, a lot of them read it as simply a crime novel. Three violent deaths, bootlegging, drinking, you know, sex, all of that. And that's where they stopped with their reading of the novel. Fitzgerald's literary friends, Gertrude Stein, Edith Wharton, who we just talked about, T.S. Eliot, they knew it was a masterpiece. But the popular press, the most famous headline of a review of The Great Gatsby was in the New York World in 1925, and the headline read, "Fitzgerald's Latest, a Dud." So, you know, Fitzgerald dies and he thinks the novel basically has died with him. And during World War II, there's this amazing program where editors, librarians, paper manufacturers, they all get together in New York. They want to do something for the war effort. So they come up with this idea of producing cheap paperbacks to distribute for free to soldiers and sailors serving overseas and guys in prisoners of war camps in Germany and Japan. These cheap paperbacks are called the Armed Services Editions. Over 1,000 titles, everything from My Friend Flicka to Margaret Mead's Coming of Age in Samoa to Moby Dick to The Great Gatsby is chosen as one of the titles. 155,000 copies of The Great Gatsby are distributed to the armed services. The editions themselves were printed on pulp paper. They're long rectangles. They were meant to fit in the servicemen's pockets, their front pockets. The greatest distribution, by the way, was on the eve of D-Day. Every guy getting into a landing craft had an armed services edition in his pocket. And one of the most popular titles was A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. That was a D-Day title. So all of a sudden, this novel, which is nowhere upon Fitzgerald's death, 155,000 copies meant to be read, each copy about 7 times. You know, do the math. That's about 1 million readings of The Great Gatsby. And then after World War II, we get the paperback revolution. Gatsby is picked up. And we get a second Great Gatsby movie in 1949 starring Alan Ladd. That's filmed almost like a film noir. The first shot you see of Alan Ladd as Gatsby, he's leaning out of a speeding roadster, machine gunning down his rivals in the bootleg business.
Do you think the book, I mean, it's one thing to say it got printed and handed to men under duress who didn't have much else to read, although it's in good company. You've got Moby Dick in your back pocket, yeah. I suppose, and there's The Great Gatsby in your top pocket. But is there any indication that there was something about... I mean, they must have liked the book. It's more than just they had it and read it. And is there something about that period? Did it enjoy a revival because it was a book maybe ahead of its time? It was waiting for that moment.
I think you're right about that. And I've looked at the Armed Services edition of Gatsby. The Library of Congress here in Washington has the only complete collection. It's open to the public. You can go in and ask for any of the titles, and you can handle those books and wonder about where they came from, what they saw, so to speak. The way Gatsby is advertised on the back of the Armed Services edition, it's advertised like a crime story, like an action-adventure story. Now, obviously, whoever wrote, you know, that blurb on the back was trying to make it appealing to the guys serving overseas. But it's a rough story. It's a tough story. It's an uncompromising story. I think it's of a piece with the times after World War II. You know, it's not a story that tells us a fairy tale about America. If that were the case, Gatsby would still be alive at the end, and he'd be living with Daisy in his beautiful mansion. It's a story that's alert to the tough realities of life.
It dovetails beautifully with the movement toward noir film and fiction at the time, and I suppose
it does.
It's a terrific read, Maureen. Thank you so much for this book and for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank.
Maureen Corrigan, the author of So We Read On, How The Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Also, a book critic for NPR's Fresh Air. She's going to be in Asheville tonight reading from Malaprop's books, and in Chapel Hill this Friday reading from Flyleaf Books. If you want more information about that or anything else we've talked about, go to our website, stateofthings.org. A program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is the intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. I'm Frank Stachow.